Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining me now is Wesley Yang, contributing editor at Esquire magazine and a columnist at Tablet magazine. He has a new book called The Souls of Yellow Folk. Wesley, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So the Souls of Yellow Folk obviously sounds like a nod to the classic W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk. I assume that was on purpose?
It was on purpose. It was a kind of half facetious reference that points out the kind of the enormous gulf between the sort of the situation that Du Bois was addressing back then and the one that I'm addressing today. And yet there is something that is that there's something that both of those situations do in fact have in common. So
for example, Du Bois used the term double consciousness to describe how black people must be conscious of how they view themselves and at the same time be conscious of how the white world views them. So is it something along those lines, or how does that? Obviously it is. So how does that apply to the Asian American experience?
I think it does very much, right? I mean, we have arrived at that condition by very different means and on the basis of a completely different set of historical experiences, and yet there is this kind of psychological facet of the Asian American conundrum that has to do with sort of, in spite of the sort of this the success of Asian Americans, which is something that is kind of well known, there is a lingering sense of social exclusion or alienation, and along with that comes with a sense of constant scrutiny of the place that the kind of the disputed and also kind of largely suppressed role, that kind of the kind of liminal place of the Asian American within our system that we mostly conceive of, you know, even today as the country becomes ever more multicultural and ever more multiracial, we still think of the country as a kind of bimodal system, right, of black and white. And sort of the you know, especially the Asian American, it's the most obscure and least understood. And it hasn't quite been kind of metabolized into our understanding of an increasingly diverse country.
And so, for example, there's the paradox that Asian American kids are so overrepresented at schools like Stuyvesant and Bronx Science here in New York. That gets talked about a lot. While at the same time, the percentage of Asian Americans in poverty in New York is the highest among any group, according to stats that I've seen. That's a paradox that a lot of non-Asians would have a hard time keeping in their minds.
Yes. I mean, there's this kind of bimodal distribution of the condition of life, particularly in New York City. And of course, you know, there are areas, among, you know, Asians are present among, you know, in New York City's investment banks and hedge funds, but they're also present as the people working, you know, several jobs and delivering your Chinese food. And so this is a part of, you know, the kind of liminal condition of the Asian American.
So Asian American listeners, how do you perceive your Asian American-ness, and how do you see the world seeing you differently? I realize that's a very general question, but we want to open this wide for wherever you want to go with it along the lines of the idea of double consciousness, as W.E.B. Du Bois once used it in The Souls of Black Folks, and as our guest Wesley Yang uses it in his new book, The Souls of Yellow Folk. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. The first essay in your book is about the Virginia Tech shooter, Sung Hee Cho. Why start with a violent criminal?
Well, that's a good question. For me, that essay was a kind of formative work, and I was sort of conscripted into this thing that I would probably not have done on my own, which is to start sort of addressing the question of an Asian American identity and my Asian American identity. And so as I describe sort of in the introductory essay of my book, it was an essay that sort of looked at the kind of unusual, that kind of used him as a proxy and a foil to look at the kind of alienation that is often felt, in particular by Asian men, this sense that we are, you know, despite sort of the academic successes that Asians have seen, there's this sense, you know, that of a kind of exclusion. And it's an exclusion that's kind of difficult to articulate, but it's felt very strongly. And I think many people, it was not entirely clear in kind of his writings and his manifestos, where Cho talked about sort of what motivated him in his act, that he even perceived it within the framework of an Asian American identity. And yet many Asian Americans, I'm not going to say all of them, but it certainly was true of myself, were not able to witness this event, you know, without seeing it within that framework. Although the framework, it was not entirely clear to what extent, right? It really had to do with race. But one suspected that it had something to do with it. And so that's why I wrote about it.
On a lighter note, I think it's a lighter note, you bring up three proverbs in the book to juxtapose Asian culture with American culture. The loudest duck gets shot is a Chinese proverb. The loudest duck gets shot. The nail that sticks out gets hammered down is a Japanese one. And in the West, we say the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I think I get the contrast, but what are you getting at?
Well, I mean, these are very broad, systematic differences that happen. And it just has to do with, like, the way one is expected to orient oneself in a public setting. And so when it comes to this question of sort of the advancement of Asian Americans into into positions of kind of visibility or leadership, the reality is that throughout corporate America, it's often the case that there will be many Asian Americans at a lower level, but they're the group that is least likely to make it into senior management. And this is something that is, you know, also connected to the kind of lack of visibility of Asian Americans in the popular culture. That's a kind of simple proxy for something that is, you know, much deeper. It has to do with the sense that many Haitians feel that they are sort of by default sort of consigned at best to a kind of tertiary role. And the question of this is whether or not this has something to do with race or if it has something to do with differing norms and expectations in the culture. And the answer is that there's not a simple, you know, there's not a single simple answer. It's a little bit of both. And it depends upon the way that you see it. And precisely because it is kind of a little bit of both of those things, the subject is often not really discussed or thought about. And yet precisely because, you know, it is kind of liminal in this way and contested in this way, it can be a fascinating thing to inquire into sort of the very nature of this exclusion itself. And that's why eventually I came to see how the kind of this subject that is default, not one that people want to think about, could serve as a kind of fulcrum point, right, in the way that we think about the way social racial identity is constructed and operates in general.
And also, I think you're making a contrast here that in the two Asian proverbs, the Chinese one and the Japanese one, if you stand out, there is negative attention paid to you. And in the American context, if you stand out even in a negative way, there is positive attention paid to you. The squeaky wheel gets the grease, which contrasts with the two Asian proverbs, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down and the loudest duck gets shot. Yes?
Yes. I mean, it's just a basic orientation to the question of self-assertion, right, in the face of contestation. And sort of, in a very broad sort of level, the norms and expectations of various Asian cultures, have historically and traditionally been to sort of regard it as improper, right, to assert yourself in circumstances where, in the kind of more libertarian American setting, where it becomes necessary to assert yourself individually.
We'll continue in a minute with Wesley Yang and his soul and his book, The Souls of Yellow Folks. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Wesley Yang, contributing editor at Esquire magazine, columnist at Tablet magazine, and author of the new book, The Souls of Yellow Folk, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Ryan on Staten Island, you're on WNYC with Wesley Yang. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention, you know, how, like, as an Asian American, you know, when I was growing up, I always felt kind of like an outsider, you know, like always surrounded by like people like white and black and everyone else, and like so few Asians around me all the time, you know. And I think something that contributes to that feeling of being outside is Asian parenting. You know, like there's like an aspect of Asian parenting that I feel people don't talk about as much, which is that Asian parents tend to compare their kids a lot to other kids, you know, especially kids who are doing like really well in school or in their careers. And there's just like that constant pressure to succeed and, you know, just constantly being compared to like, oh, like the white families or the rich people and stuff like that. Like the Asian parents will like say it with those words. And I don't know, I just wanted to mention that as a contributing factor to feeling outside of, you know, American society.
Wesley, you want to talk to Ryan?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, Asian parents, like many other parents that arrive here from other parts of the world, including parts of Europe or Eastern Europe, often just emerge from like totally pre-Freudian cultures, right? Where like, yeah, you know, sort of this notion that you wouldn't like immediately start haranguing your child about their weight or their appearance the instant you see them. It's just not that idea, right? That form of like, you know, politesse simply does not exist, right? With people, you know, sort of people that come from immigrant cultures. And this is, of course, it follows across the board, not just with appearance, but like kind of like open sort of comparison and competition between children. Like that's just like a baseline, and that's just how it is. And of course, it's going to have an effect on people's psyches.
Ryan, thank you very much. How are you feeling about the meritocracy these days? There's the lawsuit that is at least on paper on behalf of Asian American applicants to Harvard, who say they're getting passed over so that Harvard can allow more Black and Latino students in. And they don't have the equal qualifications, you know, at the same rate as looked at statistically. Where are you on that suit?
Yeah, well, I mean, the claim is also that sort of relative to their sort of equally sort of qualified white counterpart, you know, that there is some statistical evidence, or this was the argument that the plaintiffs brought, that the white students were advantage relative to the Asian American students. And so one of the most sort of telling examples of this was that in an area called Sparse Country, sort of Harvard kind of divvies up the country into different regions and recruits differently in each of those regions. So in rural parts of the United States, Harvard will send recruiting letters to white students who score 13, 10 and above on the SAT. But they will only send letters to Asian students living in the same part of the country if they score 1360 or above. So that's a pretty clear-cut case, right, of a form of favoritism. And sort of when the Harvard director of admissions, William Fitzsimmons, was questioned about this, his answer did not sort of dispel, let us say that his answer did not dispel the initial perception that this difference could only exist, you know, for the purpose of conferring favoritism on white people from Sparse Country relative to their similarly their more qualified Asian counterparts. And so, you know, the Harvard case, I think, in many ways is kind of indicative of this issue that I've been describing. The kind of the predicate of the case is that on the basis of Harvard's own kind of academic and extracurricular profiles of students, it has been shown that Asian Americans have by far the best academic records in terms of grades and SAT scores and APs, and that they've actually at this point become more nominally well-rounded in the sense that they do more extracurricular activities than their white counterparts. And so there are three components to this scoring system, three different profiles. And on the third profile, which is the personality profile, which is a very kind of subjective measurement of the personal qualities that a person has, including their effervescence and their kindness and other qualities for which there are no kind of objective determinants, Asians lag behind all other groups. And they lag behind all other groups in a manner in which is highly suggestive of the fact that there is a kind of post hoc hack that was done to prevent Asians from taking a larger share of the Harvard class than they already do. Now, the reality is that any person who is a kind of plausible candidate to Harvard University and a plausible enough candidate to feel slighted by their rejection, for the most part, will not be material harmed in any huge way by not getting in, because they'll simply go to some other excellent college, maybe even California Institute of Technology or a school like that, that in many ways better than Harvard at certain things. But on the other hand, there is something kind of uniquely psychologically injurious to this institution that is so clearly revered above almost any other institution in the world by the Asian community, precisely because they come from cultures that have this reverence for educational institutions and for educational achievement, that their personalities are being rated at a level that is systematically lower than their white counterparts, despite their higher achievement, despite the fact that they've put themselves through doing more extracurricular activities. And so, to me, it kind of fits in with the general kind of thesis of the book, which is that there's this remaining level of a sense of exclusion, a sense of alienation, that has in part to do with sort of the ordinary kind of cultural struggles that people make on the path to acculturation, but that also has to do with the lingering effect of racial stereotyping on people. And so there's a kind of combination of things that are at work, and it's at work in the case of Harvard in a way that is just so kind of painfully obvious, right? I mean, in the sense that, like, what is it that is said about all of these kind of, you know, Asian American achievements? They were regarded as kind of mechanical, robotic, and in the end kind of soulless, right? Mm-hmm. As part of this kind of pursuit of looking good on paper, mm-hmm. right, rather than having yes. any actual qualities.
Hence this.
And if you listen to kind of sort of the way Harvard defends its policy, they continue to, you know, they continually say that, like, your grades and SATs are merely table stakes, and we're evaluating you along multiple dimensions, including, like, how interesting you are in late night conversation, what kind of roommate mm-hmm. you're going to be, what you're going to be like at the table. And when we look at this kind of pattern of, you know, systematic lower personality scores, it's very hard to avoid the implication that their defense is that these people are simply lamer than other people.
Well, we have to leave it there with Wesley Yang, whose new book is The Souls of Yellow Folk. Can you tell us in literally 15 seconds, now that you moved from New York to Montreal, whether you experience any difference along these lines up there?
Yeah, it's pretty different. Like, the cultures up here are less assimilated, and it's more a kind of collection of communities that live side by side rather than a kind of single community into which one assimilates or does not assimilate.
Interesting, and definitely fodder for follow-up the next time we talk. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks so much.